I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/Inner Academy.
Hello and welcome to the Shakti Hour, a podcast on Ram Dass Be Here Now Network, where I speak with women about their personal experience on the spiritual path. My name is Melanie, and today I'm sharing a talk I had with master herbalist and healer Yulia Graves. I was first introduced to Yulia through my friend and acupuncturist Mia Hatkes, who invited me to a workshop that Yulia was giving at Flower Power in the East Village in New York City. And I had such a great experience with her flower essences and from studying briefly with her and working with her one-on-one. She has so much wisdom to share, not just only around plant medicine and healing, but how all of that works together on the spiritual path for women and men alike. So we talked already way last fall, and this conversation has been sitting here on my computer, and it felt like the right moment to share it with you. So I hope that you will enjoy it and take a moment to go to the Shakti Hour page at BeHereNowNetwork.com, where you will find the Amazon link to purchase Yulia's books and a link to her website, lilycircle.com, where you can learn more about her flower essence offerings and other plant teachings. Please also remember to subscribe to the Shakti Hour on iTunes, and thanks very much for listening.
Okay, so I'm here today with a master herbalist, flower essence creator, healer and friend Yulia Graves. I'm in Paris, she's in Provence, and we're going to get right to it. So I'm going to start, Yulia, by just letting you tell a little bit about your own path and what you're doing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I was very lucky in that I was born in 1966 in Germany, which was a time when that was not a spiritual country. The hippie movement was in the US and not really in Europe, and I was in a very bourgeois setting. However, luckily, and by the power of my karma, I happened to be in a neighborhood where some of the women decided to start doing transcendental meditation according to Maharishi Yogi. And one of our neighbors, she was doing yoga. And then when I say this to people, they imagine, again, these hippie women. They were not hippie women. They were complete middle-class housewives, stay at home and look after the kids kind of a setup. So because of that, when I was 11, I was introduced to TM, Transcendental Meditation. And I had a very, very great interest in that. I had an inner voice really saying, like, meditation is your life. And I had an expectation of the initiation that as an 11-year-old from that culture, I could not put into words. However, then, you know, at that time, it so happened my hometown was the European Center for Transcendental Meditation. Still, the initiation had been shortened down to nothing. There was no ritual. And I remember, I think this was a karmic memory of initiation. I remember walking out as this 11-year-old child going like, there was no initiation. What just happened? She just taught me how to meditate. So I really loved the meditation, and it had very strong effect on me immediately, on my mind, in terms of experiences of light and expansion. However, I am the youngest, and at that time I was 11. I wasn't fully grown. I was also the smallest and weakest in a large dysfunctional family. And I noticed very on meditating. I had, you know, we had to sleep with the window open, so it was freezing waking up in the winter. In my room, I was supposed to sit for 20 minutes in my jammies. I said to my mother, can I have a blanket to wrap myself in? She thought that was a complete waste of money. I didn't have a proper place to sit in. My bed had a mattress that hangs through, so I was hanging there under the shelf, freezing, having all these mystical experiences that I had no context for.
Wow.
In my culture, from my background, that I didn't even know I could talk to the meditation teacher about, because my mother was the go-between. You know, when you're a child being initiated, your mother is the mediator between you and the teacher. And there was, after a couple of weeks, there was a voice in me that said, you can't keep doing this. And it kind of broke my heart, but I had the wisdom to stop, because it just, you know, it's like trying to reach enlightenment while you're in a U.S. high security prison being attacked, you know, having attempts on your life. You shouldn't be doing this. It's not the place to open up.
And such a disconnect, too, to be offered that and then to be denied the support around it. Yeah.
Yes, I don't think they imagine children having spiritual experiences much. So I waited until I was 18 and I moved away from home. And basically the next week I went back to the meditation teacher because I figured, well, I'm 18 now. Now I can go without my mom. And I asked her to teach me again. But she showed me again. And from then on, I started my daily meditation practice. And because I no longer lived at home, I had just moved out, it was actually possible. The same thing happened. I immediately had very strong experiences of light, expansion, deep inner peace. I didn't know at that time what it was, because, again, there was no cultural context whatsoever. I had a lot of experiences of chakras opening. It wasn't until, I think, 5-6 years later, possibly more, that I even heard the term chakra for the first time. So it was all really out of cultural context. And these experiences became so strong that I think about 2 years later, I went back to the meditation teacher and described. And I think she was completely helpless. I can't explain this, but she said to me, stop meditating and go jogging. So I had the second heartbreak of what's that? You know, I felt that it was wrong. It was a very difficult experience for me to disobey her as my meditation teacher. And I said, I'm not going to stop. I'm not going to go jogging. And it wasn't because I wasn't exercising. I was an active performing dancer, and I was biking probably the equivalent of 10 to 15 miles a day. So I didn't see the point in jogging. And no explanation. So from then on, I started to meditate by myself, trying to be my own teacher. This wasn't by choice. It was just because I had no other option. And I did that for many years with, again, a lot of very strong internal experiences, for which, because I was very interested in spirituality and I slowly, you know, heard more things, understood more, New Age was slowly coming to Germany. I was able to find a context for it. And then at a certain point, actually, somebody gave me 2 tapes of Ram Dass giving talks. And that was incredibly helpful. It was like, wow, suddenly, you know, somebody gave me some kind of a context for something at all. And then one of the things Ram Dass says on these tapes is, you know, at a certain point in your life, you have to go look for a spiritual tradition. You know, you have to go around and sample on the spiritual buffet, but then you also have to make up your mind and choose your tradition. So I decided I should probably try to find the spiritual buffet and start sampling, which is what I did. Then I moved to Findhorn, which is a spiritual community in northern Scotland, with practitioners from all different spiritual traditions, Christianity.
I have heard of Findhorn. I had, as a teenager myself, I had fantasized about that place.
Right. And it was good for me because it's very based also in working with plants. And I've worked with healing plants since childhood because my mother is an herbalist and she trained me since I was a child. So that was a good fit for me. And there, very, very quickly, I mean, it's so funny that you just mentioned Jack Kornfield. One of the first books that somebody gave to me there was Jack Kornfield's Heart of Wisdom. And the first page says, you know, when you're on the spiritual path, you really have to make up your mind what you really want to do in life. And I was sitting under a pine tree and I just looked up in the sky and I said, I want to go to Nepal, which just popped into my mind in that moment. So within the next couple of weeks, I got myself on a trip of people from Findhorn. I had just moved there to Nepal, and against the plans of that trip, landed in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery where they had just started their huge annual meditation course. And they wouldn't admit me because I wasn't even a Tibetan Buddhist. And the nuns at the registrations, they were really, really trying to get rid of me. And I said, no, but I had a dream. I did have a visionary dream also. I said, like, I'm supposed to be here. And they were like, oh God, this deluded woman, what are we going to do with her? They very, very begrudgingly let me join. But for me, it was a true coming home and really finding my spiritual tradition. And they were very shocked, actually, that had never happened, that somebody had turned up out of the blue for such a strict retreat with such, if I may say so, heavy spiritual teachings, and fit in, you know, like a hand in a glove, and just loved every single bit of it. And I walked out a Tibetan Buddhist.
So just in this story, I'm happy to hear this story. What do you think gave you that strength to follow all those callings, each of those steps to stop meditating, to start meditating again, to get yourself to find, you know, there's something in you, or where did that come from in you that you were able to do that?
Well, I really am convinced that, you know, you come in with your own karma and your imprints of your past life. And, you know, it wasn't until then, much later, that I started to see that there had been signs all along in my life. For instance, one of my 2 godparents had grown up in Burma, and for my christening, she gave me a little carved Buddha. And my place at the table at home was across a porcelain Kuan Yin statue that my parents had for mere decoration, but I was always looking at Kuan Yin. And my father, in his surgery, had a Saraswati, an antique Indian Saraswati statue. And when I was 4 or 5, I loved the statue so much. And all I knew about the statue was it's from India, that I said to my dad, Dad, can't we all move to India and you'll be the poor people there? And he was horrified. Mm. So I mean, I also mentally was not like the rest of my family. He actually said to me, the natives are going to get angry and they will all kill us. That was it. Were his exact words. I was completely shocked and horrified. And there was actually a time as I was meditating already before I found Tibetan Buddhism officially, when I had heard about Tara and I became obsessed about Tara. This is all before the internet. People don't understand anymore right. how that was.
Right.
But I would go into libraries and pull books off the shelf and look in the register in the back of if they would say anything about Tara, because I didn't even know who she was. I was just somehow compelled to look for her. And when I moved to Fintown, they actually have a stone with Tara's mantric seed syllable carved on it. And I would just stand in front of it and cry and pray and start to prostrate. I didn't even know I was prostrating. It was just very deep karmic memories welling up from another life. All these things, also when I was a child, I always really, really wanted to go to Manjushri's mountain in China. Hmm. I kept on saying, the Chinese will arrest me, throw me in prison and kill me, and I will die without my family knowing where I am. Hmm. So I think that that's actually what happened in my last life, because I'm born at the same time, you know, like within a year after the Chinese massively killed people in Tibet. And there are a lot of parallel cases like that. So at that time, the Chinese were massively killing the Tibetans, really reducing population and the birth rate through, you know, criminal, you know, tubilations of women. That was a politics to keep the population down. So you couldn't reincarnate in that culture at that time. So then the next thing is a phenomenon that, you know, so many of my generation pop up worldwide and want to be Tibetan Buddhists. So that's an intellectualization, but it's definitely clear to me that my mind was very different from when I was born from the rest of the people in my family. I was very inclined to do different things. I just wasn't like them, so.
And that really is the spiritual journey.
Yes.
And with this strong spirit leading you.
Yeah. Yes.
And I can relate, too, to feeling, I mean, I used to look in the drawers of my parents' bedrooms for my adoption papers because I was sure that I couldn't have been from this family. But yeah. Not that they're I mean, they're a lovely family, but I felt so different from them. I wasn't adopted, but that kind of spiritual pull, I can relate to that being more powerful than my own egoic desires.
Right. And it's not that I didn't try Christianity. So I grew up in Northern Germany, which is largely Protestant, which translates into atheists. So nobody was essentially practicing. And I really, even as a child, I'd go to church every now and then and really sit there and try to get something spiritual. And each time I just couldn't find anything spiritual in it. The pastor didn't believe in God. His wife was suicidal. I mean, there wasn't much. And then when I had confirmation classes, you know, the smartest thing we got to learn is that the Bible is a library because it contains more than one book. And I felt so insulted in my spirituality. I remember thinking, you know, looking at the pastor thinking, you honestly think that that's all I want to know about God and truth and spirituality? And I remember getting so enraged. So we get confirmed at 14 that I read the whole Bible front to back. I mean, I read the whole thing. I said, okay, I'm going to find out for myself. But even then, it was not for me. Obviously, it wasn't the right fit for me, Christianity. It didn't speak to me in the way that Eastern philosophies or Buddhism speaks. So I remember being pretty disappointed with the Bible. I had gone to Bible class as a young child every Sunday for fun and to draw pictures. And I didn't really find out anything about Jesus I didn't already know. So I gave Christianity a thorough try.
Yeah. Yeah. I certainly would have been more inclined to find other things, I'm sure, had I not been so drawn to music. Because definitely in the Christian church, that's what kept me coming back. And that's where I found spirit, was through singing and playing that music. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. I loved singing. So I sang in the Catholic church choir because the Protestant church didn't have one. And so what I found out that the Catholics, you know, they have communion every Sunday, but they fight. Boy, do they fight in the congregation. So I actually stopped attending after a couple of years because it had started to hurt me that in the name of the Christ, they were all fighting all the time. So,
Right. Well,
this is not something that the Buddhists are free of either, if I may say so.
So this journey of coming home and finding this place, is that still where your practice is rooted in Tibetan Buddhism from that training? Is that what you consider your foundational training, that time you spent in the monastery there?
Yes and no. I mean, to understand Tibetan Buddhism, there are actually three or four levels, if you wish, because it's a path that includes Hinayana, Mahayana, and Vajrayana Buddhism. And then at a certain level, you could say that there's even a level beyond. And if you wish, when you come to Tibetan Buddhism as a Westerner and not like the Tibetans, they think because they're born Tibetan, they're genetic Buddhists. They don't need to behave that way, know anything. They're just Buddhists because they have the genes. So if you come because that's your spiritual calling, it's like you're unmolded. And then it's a very rigorous training. It's very, how can I say, ritualistic and strict in many, many ways. So I really wanted to excel. So I really squeezed myself into the mold to the nth degree. And then there came these years of tremendous betrayal when I found out that no matter what I did and what I achieved or how I excelled, they just didn't want a Western laywoman. They want Tibetan ordained males to excel, period. And so it is, I make the difference between Buddhism as an ism, that means a doctrine, a religious hierarchical system that is meant to preserve a status quo of maintaining itself in the name of a doctrine and ultimate truth, which is what it's about. So that I call the Dharma, to make the difference. So I never had any conflict with the Dharma.
Right.
The Dharma never discriminated against me. It was never against me. It was only always completely for me. However, the human beings I encountered for the most part were within the encrusted monastic hierarchies of Buddhism. Ism means, you know, an exaggerated state of something. And that's what this rigid mold that I had to shed and also break free from if I didn't want it to suffocate me in the end.
Interesting now hearing your story over time like this, of these kind of repeated moments of connecting with the Dharma, connecting with the heart, and then having this block or this,
yes,
I don't, yes, know what to call it, thrown in the path. And so wanting just to shift gears a little bit now into knowing about the Lily Circle and how all of those attempts to stop your, maybe not deliberate, I don't know how you feel about them, if they were deliberate or not, but how, knowing about the Lily Circle, then you were able to create this expression, this whole language and expression through your healing. Can you say a bit about that, how that?
Yeah, I think it's really a coming together, a flowing together, because obviously I was also doing something professionally while I was meditating and doing all of those things. Although I spent 3 years studying in the monastery in Dharamsala, I spent 4 years in closed, isolated retreat. But outside of that, I actually started by studying medicine and holistic medicine at this time. And, you know, I think it's very hard for someone to witness women being pregnant and giving birth without not having this sensation that you just want to protect them forever. And so I was working as a psychotherapist, herbalist, you know, healer with all the natural modalities, and mostly then you work with women, and most of them are mothers and they have little children. So I felt very, very protective of them in my work. And one thing that I saw, not only in their lives, but also in my spiritual experience, is the crushing of the feminine. And so I felt very strongly to do something to change that. So I created the Lily Circle, which is a set, a kit, a system of flower essences. They're all made from botanical lilies. And they represent within the botanical family realm the essence of the feminine, and the feminine on all levels. So they are gynecological remedies, but they also strengthen the archetypal feminine, the feminine divine, for instance, Madonna Lily, but also, you know, feminine qualities such as intuition, dream awareness, softness, openness, gentleness, all of those things. I also found those sorely lacking in men. And so I put them together as a mandala-like circle that represents the circle of life from conception and birth through maturity to wisdom, transcendence, and death. Death here can mean, you know, outer or inner death, end of a cycle. And that has been, I never imagined it being ever an online ordering website kind of a thing. However, the women loved it so much. My students loved it so much. The body workers I was training, everybody getting such wonderful results. So I've been very touched and grateful for the fact that I was able to give back something to my fellow sisters, a gift of healing.
Yeah, and I can attest to the profound impact of these essences myself, definitely. I use them and have turned a lot of people onto them who all love them and use them, mostly women, although I have shared some, begun to share some with some of the men that I work with. And it, I'm curious, this is a bit of an aside, but I'm curious of the sensitivity of is there a sensitivity necessary or needed ahead of time to experience the benefits? Do you feel,
you know, or coming back to the question of what's different between men and women? Women are wired, maybe because of socialization or because they're born that way, to be in touch with their bodies. Women feel their bodies. They experience, now I have an ache here, and now something is off there, and I feel my emotions, my intuition is talking to me. They're in touch with that. Men are systematically brainwashed to create a gap and a distance to their body, their emotions, their sensations, their intuition. This is, by the way, even worse when you're a Tibetan monk in the monastery. You don't have a mom, you're there since you're a child. Nobody even cares if you're sick or coughing. And they don't even know what to say when they come to the doctor, because they don't even have vocabulary for what's wrong with my body or this thing, or even feel anything about it. So with men, it's not that flower essences don't work, but they won't notice it because they're completely cut off. It's like that thing is happening over there, that thing that's my body, my energy body shifts in it, shifts in my thought patterns, and so on and so forth. So basically, men will miss that the flower essence is shifting something in them unless they have done that conscious work of bridging the gap.
Right.
Those men, yes, they will immediately feel something.
Right, right. But it's not that the effect isn't happening, right?
Right, which you can find out from the wife and the children. They'll
Correct.
Say it's less grouchy or things like that, you
right.
know?
Right, right, right.
Yeah.
So how is that, how, so given the past and then this method that you, don't want to call it a method. It really is like a, I'm going to say masterpiece, but it really feels like the culmination of this, of your spiritual journey, like that, the right livelihood embodied in this gift of the flower essences. So mm-hmm. given that past and kind of this thing has been created now, where are you now in your spiritual journey? How has that shifted for you now over time, now that you've actually created a nest from which to have a safe spiritual, have a very personalized spiritual experience?
Yeah, I don't think that if you really understand the spiritual path that it ever feels like a nest or a haven, because what you're really doing is you're trying to pull the rug out underneath ego. So it constantly feels like you're falling down a cliff, you know, into an abyss like the Grand Canyon. You're not even sure there's a bottom to it, you know. So I think I would be pretty upset if I felt like I was in a safe nest, because it would mean to me that I'm really doing something wrong. I don't look for that. Where I am since the Lily Circle, so I also did the Lily Circle when I was in New York, really studying a lot of Buddhism there. Manhattan, New York City is incredibly male-driven, so it was really also kind of an antidote to that, yeah, extremely exaggerated lopsidedness to Western culture. And since then, things also have changed. We are just going through a period virtually in the world where there are a lot of very extreme shifts and a lot of fear, and a lot of fear-mongering also. And so I actually developed another very small range, just 8 essences that I call the spiritual warrior essences, because I felt that even spiritual people, I'm not trying to offend anybody here, but just for lack of a different way of putting it, but they were such wimps, you know? So, I mean, spirituality is about opening and thus you become more sensitive, but then it's not like, ooh, so-and-so looked at me the wrong way, and ooh, they're aggressive people in the street. I mean, it's supposed to make you very strong, and it's supposed to, I mean, if you look at the ancient scriptures, if you really study them, they talk about the yogis and yoginis stepping up in the face of black magicians, in the face of armies. Yes. You don't shrink back from these kind of challenges. And I guess I've always had quite a rebellious and warrior-like side to me. Even before I became a Buddhist, you know, I'd be going into war zones on peace pilgrimages and you know, sprinkle flower essences everywhere to try to shift the energy and just really like be up against the, well, shelling, things like that.
Yeah.
So, which was maybe a little bit extreme and crazy, but I'm very glad I did it. And I just felt like I needed to also give the world some flower essences for real courage and to stand up in the face of challenge. And negativity, which is the theme right now. We'll maybe be coming out of it again. I hope so. I hope we'll get through this crazy phase to another more peaceful phase. My work is ongoing, and I'm really trying to also train people more. I have never been asked to be a spiritual teacher because my brother and sister Buddhists think I look ordinary, so therefore it's very clear that I have nothing to say. I've been officially asked to shut up when people ask me to explain about emptiness, you know, which I only studied 3 years in a monastery in Tibetan from the ancient sutras. And the reason was, shut up, you're a woman. So I'm not dumb. I learn fast. I said, you know what, don't bother even trying to teach Westerners. They don't want to hear you. I don't look Asian. I don't want a transgender operation to look like a Tibetan monk. So I just leave it to other people. So what I can do right now, I can train people in healing themselves, in a spiritual context that's outside of a spiritual hierarchy, dogma, prefixed ideas. And the moment I'm with plants and healing, I magically look right. They all think I have something smart to say about that. So that's what I can do now.
Yeah. Well, and you do. And I can say to the and I can say to the spiritual warrior essences that definitely when I was here in Paris in February and March, I was literally dependent on them to help keep my auric field and keep my center, because just going out into the world here at that time, it's so much better now, would be draining. I would come back and just to go out to get lunch, I'd come back and have to take a nap.
Right,
and they were so powerfully keeping me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just for the context of the listeners, that was after the terrorist attacks. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and I know, and also just in hearing your story a bit more, I know that I would say that you are a spiritual teacher in teaching through your experience. And each of these things you've created is a way to support other people on their own journeys. That's been my experience of working with you. And I know that when I was transitioning out of one, just to back up a second, what I really like about your story is the strength of you throughout each of these, the you of you, throughout each of these different studies or different communities. And just, you know, for all of us on the spiritual path to know that you continue on through that.
Right.
And finding your way. And that definitely in working with you, I had, you helped to provide that support for me to transition from one group that I had outgrown into another more authentic spiritual path. Which is something that I think, I know Ram Dass himself talks about it often, that, you know, each teacher is your teacher, right? It's not that there's a bad teacher and a good teacher, but that somehow this helping each other to stay true and authentic to our spiritual journey, I feel like that's a lot of what I've gotten from working with you and with your essences.
Yeah, I think one of, you know, being also a psychotherapist trained in looking at dysfunctional groups, one of the problem with religions as exaggerated dogmatic institutions is that they somehow create the illusion that once you step out of the sangha or the congregation, you step out of the love and grace of the divine. And it does feel that way, because the group projection of projecting that as true is so powerful that it makes true. And I think one very helpful thing is to remind oneself that that is not true. I think for me, this is where it's like a blessing that I started as a child in a completely non-spiritual and non-philosophical context, because I can always fall back to the knowledge that I had all these profoundly spiritual experiences. You don't need to know a chakra exists for it to open, you know?
Right.
So you don't need to have heard about Shakti to experience it. So I think that helped me. You've been asking how I've been able to always pick myself up by the bootstraps. I think it's my personality, but I think there are maybe three factors. It's my personality, it's how I am. I just never give up. I think coming from a dysfunctional family really helps, because you have to just fight for your survival. And then coming from a universal spiritual matrix place into the religious dogma helps you to know that not all is lost when you leave again and you're back in this natural matrix, although there's the dogma is telling you that now you got it all wrong, you know.
Right.
Not the sadhana word by word, you know, the visualization isn't exactly right, you know, for each eyelash and things like that. And then there's the moment where you say to yourself, so what? You know, and that there is spiritual work beyond that. Like, for instance, we talked about it briefly, the Haiti clinic we've been doing. It is such spiritually powerful work to do social service, to save people's lives, you know? So what, you never have a direct vision of some divinity, which isn't the real point anyways. But the power of saving human lives, taking care of those who are hungry, those who are sick, and who have nobody else to look after them, that is unbelievably powerful and carries you more than 100,000, 1 million mantras or whatever number you want to put to it.
Right. It's like a love, serve, remember.
Yes.
So as we, this has been wonderful. And just as we wrap up, I've been asking everyone I speak with if they were to offer a piece of wisdom or advice for women and girls that are on the spiritual path currently, what would it be?
Trust your heart.
Trust your heart.
Yes. In a nutshell, if I had to make it longer, then I would say, trust your heart. Don't ever let a male or female spiritual teacher talk you out of the wisdom of your heart.
That's wonderful. Great. Well, thank you so much, Yulia. We'll have links to Yulia's website and books and flower essences. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Yes.
Thank you so much for your time.